ask you to tell me about the stories and the literature of medieval Iceland, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Maybe it's the myths about Odin, Thor, Loki, or the end of the world of Ragnarok, as they're told in the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda. It might be the tales of the Volsungs and the heroic deeds of Sigurdr slaying Fafnir, the Valkyries Brynhildr's anger, and the deaths of Gunnar and Hogni at King Atli's court in Hinland in Volsunga Saga and the Poetic Edda. Or perhaps it's the sagas of medieval Iceland as they recount the island's settlements, feuds, and love stories of the families who made their lives there are the first things that jump to mind. Maybe in sagas such as Egil Saga or in the settlement of Greenland and the Vinland sagas. These narratives are an important part of the vibrant literary landscape of medieval Iceland. But they're not all of it. Welcome to this episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages. My name is Mary Catherine O'Connor, and I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Oxford, where I research Old Norse literature. In this episode, I'm going to talk to you about an area of medieval Icelandic, but also Norwegian literature that is perhaps not as familiar to many people as the sagas or the Eddic poetry, but one which flourished during the 13th century, and which became a popular and important part of literary production in Norway and in Iceland. Talking about Old Norse translations of Old French romances, my area of research examines the translation of space, place, and landscape in these narratives, and I investigate how these literary constructions were renegotiated in Norwegian and Icelandic contexts. In particular, I'm interested in the way in which relations of power and models' behaviour are mapped out through spatial constructions, and how modifications to the translations may reveal preconceived cultural ideologies, but also responses to the introduction of new cultural and social values through the translations. In today's episode, I'm going to talk about the role of translations in a very specific context, that is, their political and cultural role at the court of King Hákon Hákonarson in Bergen in the 13th century. And to note, while there are many types of translation throughout the Middle Ages and in medieval Norway and Iceland, I'll be focusing on vernacular translations in this episode, that is, from Old French into Old Norse, and not be talking about or dealing with Latin translations or Latin-based texts. Over the course of this episode, I will be exploring a number of questions about these translations. Why translate these texts into Old Norse? How are they translated? And what does this reveal about medieval Norwegian Icelandic society and culture? The major takeaway from this episode is to think about the role of translated literature in commuting cultural ideologies and the way in which these ideologies are themselves transformed through translation. Medieval translations formed part of the networks of cultural exchange which stretched across Europe throughout the Middle Ages. And so studying these translated narratives highlights the complex multicultural relations which shaped cultural formations and political and cultural identities. Through translation, narratives transmitted ideas across linguistic and geographic and cultural boundaries. And the Old Norse translations of Old French romances illustrate how literature helped to cultivate a shared European literary culture in medieval Norway, and later in Iceland, while also highlighting how translated texts were as much shaped by the historical and cultural context of their translation production as they were by their original composition. So let's turn to the romances themselves and discuss why these texts were chosen for translation. During the 12th century, romance with its stories of Arthur, knights on quests, and courtly love soon became, in effect, one of the best-selling secular elite genres and one of the most influential genres throughout medieval Europe. First emerging in France with the works of Chrétien de Troyes, the romance genre rapidly blossomed and spread throughout Europe as it travelled via translation, which in turn inspired new romances in a range of medieval languages, including Middle High German, Middle Dutch, Middle English, Spanish and Italian, as just some examples. By the 13th century, the stories of not only Arthur and his court, but also the Lays of Marie de France and the tales of Charlemagne and his knights found their way to medieval Norway and Iceland, where they found fertile ground for transmission and indeed inspired a new genre of medieval Icelandic literature, the chivalric sagas, or riddarasagur. So let's talk about medieval translation for just a moment. Scholars such as Rita Copeland and Sfrikadottir have analysed the vital role of translations in generating vernacular literary production throughout the Middle Ages, but also the ways in which translations themselves were shaped by different cultural ideologies and practices. So very simply, what does this actually mean? Medieval translations were often not faithful reproductions of their source texts, that is, the original language in which the narrative was produced. Rather, they frequently modified, sometimes freely adapted, or even completely rewrote and transformed the narratives. Such changes may have been introduced to achieve a number of objectives, which may have included communicating political or social ideologies, adapting unfamiliar aspects of the text to pre-existing cultural conventions and to make them more familiar to audiences, or even to make some aspects more unfamiliar, and in doing so, provide a commentary or a model on a specific social or cultural concept within the narrative. Translations could be innovative interpretations of narratives. Their modifications reveal the hermeneutic process as translators, sometimes later redactors, sought to decode, transfer, gloss, and transform material with each new iteration of a text. Divergences in the translated text are not necessarily evidence of a failure to understand the source text, but rather, they reveal responses to the text. A translator could produce a text which was more closely aligned to the ideological structures of the receiving community, that is, the language and community which it's been translated into, or the text could include explanatory details, almost like footnotes, as introduced a new system of cultural values into a language and culture. Viewed against their literary and cultural contexts, translations and their modifications highlight cultural discourses in communities, as texts could participate in reshaping cultural identities and demonstrate multicultural contacts. Cultural exchange through translation became a formative element of the cosmopolitan and multicultural court which King Haakon Haakonarsson sought to cultivate in Bergen in Norway during the 13th century. The translation of Romance into Old Norse brought an entirely new set of foreign cultural values and social ideals. Amongst these new ideals were courtliness and courtly love, but also chivalry, some of the most powerful and prevalent literary ideologies which had taken root in continental Europe during the High Middle Ages. So back to our first question. Why translate these romances? In order to answer this, we need to do a bit of scene setting. It is 1226 at the Royal Norwegian Court of Bergen, where and when a brother Robert, who is possibly a Norwegian, possibly an Anglo-Norman, it's not clear, has just translated what is considered to be one of the greatest romances of the medieval period, Thomas of Britain's Tristan, as Tristram Saga og Isolde, at the request of King Haakon. We know this because he writes it down in the prologue to the translation. Tristram Saga is widely considered to be amongst the first of a wave of Old Norse translations of Old French and Anglo-Norman romances, that is, a dialect of Old French which was spoken in England, lays and chansons de geste, which are translated during the 13th century. In fact, there are about 40 Old Norse translations of Francophone courtly literature altogether. Five of these name Haakon as the text commissioner, including Tristram Saga. In identifying the king as the instigator of these translations, these texts situate themselves within a royal cultural program. And I'll come back to this in a little while. Alongside this cultural program, the text create an image of a king interested in the literary trends of continental Europe and in shaping the literary landscape and cultural horizons of his court by importing foreign, elite, and popular literature. Brother Robert is the only named translator that we have, and he appears again, possibly as an older man with a more senior ecclesiastical position, as an abbot Robert in Elie's Saga of Rosamundu, the Old Norse translation of the Chanson de Geste, Elie de Saint-Gilles. But let's back up a tiny bit. Why did this brother Robert translate the stories of Tristan and Elie for King Haakon? To answer this, we need to look at the king himself. Haakon ruled from 1217 to 1263, and his reign is sometimes referred to as a golden age in Norwegian history. In the century before Haakon ascended to the throne, the kingdom of Norway was torn apart by civil war and political instability. It wasn't until Haakon's grandfather, King Sverre Sigurdsson, consolidated his authority that the internal fighting began to come to an end. Haakon's reign was characterized by peace, stability, and relative prosperity. Although his rule too was challenged by his father-in-law, Skule Baardsson, and it was not until he defeated Skule in 1240 that Haakon achieved absolute control over Norway. Over the course of his reign, Haakon strove to transform Norway from a minor kingdom into a major political force with significant international connections and a vibrant international cultural landscape. To achieve this, he adopted multiple strategies. Within Norway, Haakon needed to strengthen his authority and create a powerful monarchy to ensure peace and stability. He reformed the inheritance laws to ensure the succession of his legitimate sons, thereby enabling smooth political transitions, and expanded his administration to gain greater control over the kingdom. Haakon also strove to model his court along the lines of continental courts and to modify the behavior of his courtiers, his hird, to use the Old Norse term. To do this, he introduced literature which depicted the values of and ideals which were popular amongst the continental courts, and so sought to effectively Europeanize the Norwegian court. This is where translated literature comes in, but more on that later. On the international side of things, Haakon worked to transform misconceptions of his court, and he worked to raise Norway's international reputation. One example of one visitor's negative perception of the court was that of Cardinal William of Sabina. In 1247, the Pope sent his representative, Cardinal William, to Norway to officially crown Haakon. Now, Haakon had already been ruling for 30 years at this point, and his coronation would be the second official coronation ever in Norwegian history. Negotiating the visitation of a papal representative was a major diplomatic success in securing international recognition for his monarchy, and it highlights the extent of Haakon's ambitions in garnering prestige and securing papal support. But it also shows how Haakon worked to draw Norway more and more into the cultural and political spheres of continental Europe. On his way to Norway, Cardinal William stopped off in England, where he was warned by some Englishmen not to continue on his journey. They told him that he would encounter men more like animals, that the food would be terrible, and that he would receive nothing to drink, not even wine, but just poor, watered-down whey. Undeterred, the cardinal travels on to Norway, and when he arrives there, he is struck by the splendor of the court, claiming he has never seen so many ships nor people from Scandinavia and countries further afield. He eats nothing but the best food and praises Haakon. His trip and the coronation were a huge success. Now, it's important to keep in mind that this anecdote is told in an Old Norse biography of Haakon's life, Haakonssaga Haakonarsaga, and it stresses the cardinal's positive reception and perception of Bergen once he gets there. But orchestrating the cardinal's visit and the spectacle of wealth and hospitality illustrates Haakon's careful political tactics in constructing his international and domestic image. He is a king who cultivated a vision of himself as a cultured and internationally oriented king, very much a European monarch rather than one on the margins of the known world. Further on the international front, Haakon brought Greenland and Iceland under direct Norwegian control, fostered a political friendship with the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II, married his only legitimate daughter, Christine, to Philippe, the brother of Alfonso el Sabio of Castile in 1258, and he also established a formal trade agreement with England to promote exchanges of goods between the two kingdoms. A historian of Anglo-Norman relations, Henry Goddard Leach, praised Haakon's political acumen, and here I quote, "By his genial statecraft, he, that is, King Haakon, raised Norway to a place among the world powers which it has never occupied before or after," end quote. Leach was writing in 1921, and so while his description of Norway is a little antiquated, this quote gives a sense of just how successful Haakon was as a politician. Norway's relationship with England during this period was particularly important, and we're going to come back to that. A key part of Haakon's international politics was his cultural interests, and particularly the translation of courtly literature, which was closely linked to his interest in changing the behaviours of his court. Something, if you remember, I mentioned earlier. But again, this raises the question, why translate? Why these texts? What was their purpose at Haakon's court? We know, for example, from the King's Sagas, that historically skalds, poets, many of whom were Icelandic, performed at the courts of the Norwegian kings, where they composed and recited poetry, commemorated, praised, and sometimes satirized the kings. Haakon's biography was written by an Icelander, Sturla Thordarson, and on his deathbed, we are told that Haakon asked for saints' lives and kings' lives to be read to him. So there were many forms of literary entertainment available at the royal court. This brings us back to the question, why translate a new form of literature with a very different setting, social ethos, and thematic concerns? This is courtly France of forests, plains, castles, knights and ladies, courtly love and chivalry, something very foreign, very unfamiliar to a Norwegian context. This is something scholars have debated intensely, and it has crystallized historically within scholarship into more or less two poles. On the one hand, scholars such as Marian Kalinka argue that these romances were translated solely for their entertainment value. And here I'm going to quote from Kalinka. "Although King Haakon undoubtedly had cultural motives for importing French literature in the sense that he wished to be au courant with foreign literary developments, it can hardly be disputed that the desire for new entertainment and diversion also played a role in his decision to inaugurate a program of translation at his court," end quote. On the other hand, are scholars such as Geraldine Barnes, who have argued that the translations were intended to be didactic, educational, and offered models of courtly behaviour which audiences could emulate. And here I quote Barnes, "Viewed thus in the context of his aspirations for the crown and the establishment of stable government, after the preceding years of turbulence, Haakon's motives for introducing a literature which depicted an ideal and absolute king in Arthur and a model court in his company of knights become clearer in style and sentiment. The Riddarasögur have more in common with the didacticism of the Konungshuga than is generally supposed," end quote. And just to note, Konungshuga is a mirror for Prince's text which Haakon commissioned during his reign. While standing on either side of the entertainment versus didacticism debate, What is key here in both of these scholars' arguments is the cultural implication and importance of new cultural forms to the Norwegian court. The majority of scholars now agree that the translations served both purposes. They were intended to entertain and educate the courtiers of Haakon's court. Bjørn Banlien, a historian of medieval Norway, situates Haakon's interest in the romances against his political aims. And here I quote from his monograph, Strategies of Passion, Medieval Marriage in Iceland and Norway. One reason for Haakon's interest in European romances was his outward-looking cultural politics, his goal being to become one of Europe's leading royal houses. Another reason may be that he was trying, in collaboration with the church, to change the behavior of his hird. End quote. Through translating the romances, Haakon offered a new form of cultural and social practice through listening and perhaps reading the romances in which his courtiers participated in the cultural forms of entertainment of their peers elsewhere on the continent. Many of these romances, such as the Arthurian texts, presented models of strong kingship, which may have reflected Haakon's efforts to strengthen the Norwegian monarchy, while the mannerisms and values of chivalry and courtliness may have offered attractive models for reshaping the conduct of the Norwegian courtiers. On another level, these translations created cross-cultural connections and drew the Norwegian court into the wider cultural fashions which had spread throughout Europe. Although Norway never became a feudal state in the same sense as France or England, nor is it possible to determine the extent to which audiences engaged with and adopted the cultural ideas propagated by the translated romances, Haakon's program of translation revealed the fundamental potential and influence of literature in transmitting cultural ideologies across linguistic, literary, and geographical boundaries. Here it's worth noting what I mean by these ideals of courtliness and chivalry, two terms I've been sort of throwing around in the last little while. Both terms are notoriously difficult to define. And so I'm going to draw on two key scholars here, C. Stephen Jaeger and Richard Cowper. Jaeger sees courtliness as part of the civilizing process in which a social group are educated in law and civility in order to maintain social stability and order. Jaeger reads this outgrowth of courtliness in the 12th century against the violent social and historical conditions of the aristocratic military conflicts that began to characterize 12th century France, and he suggests that courtliness emerged from clerical efforts to contain and acculturate this violence, particularly young aristocratic men. Courtliness is thereby enacted through conduct, manner, and speech, and it's directed towards preconceived ends, that is, affirmation and reward for correctly performing an aestheticized mode of behavior, which reflects ideals of restraint, sophistication, and refined emotional sentiments. Closely connected to this term is chivalry, which Richard Cowper discusses as a spectrum of ideals and practices, which changed through historical periods, but which primarily functioned as an ideal set of military and social values, which elite men ascribed to and sought to perform. Shaped by 12th century aristocratic society, Romans were inflected with these ideologies of chivalry and courtliness. Authors such as Chrétien and Marie de France explored, criticized, and reflected on these ideological structures, and their narratives functioned as vehicles communicating these ideological systems. In a Norse context, a society rooted in a profoundly different ideological system and cultural set of values, these texts offered a radically different vision of ideals of elite conduct. The modifications to the translated literature reveal the negotiation in the text between achieving political objectives, introducing new cultural values, but also the interaction with pre-existing cultural and social structures and values. We've talked about the why of translation of the Norwegian court. Let's turn now to the how. How were these texts translated and how did they change? At this point, I want to return to something I mentioned earlier, England. Haakon was particularly interested in the Angevin court of Henry III of England and fostered close diplomatic relations with him. It's highly likely that many of the Francophone romances traveled via Anglo-Norman England to Norway. There were extensive trade contacts with many ships sailing between the kingdoms bringing grain to Norway from ports such as Grimsby and furs and timbers to England. Furthermore, there were several English monastic foundations in Norway where some of the translations may have been undertaken, such as Lys and Hovedøya, where Brother Robert, who I mentioned earlier as the translator of the Tristan story, may have been based at. How are the translations themselves actually carried out? The first issue to address is the question of manuscripts. All of the translated romances, except for a collection of 21 Old French lays known as strenglecker or stringed instruments, and the translation of the Chanson de Geste, Elie de Saint-Gilles as Elie Saga Rosamundu, only survive in Icelandic manuscripts, and some of them only in manuscripts from the 16th and 17th centuries. This raises the question of the reliability of these manuscripts as witnesses to the original translations. Scholars such as Kalinka argue that medieval Icelandic scribes were often active editors, more so than passive redactors, as they engaged and adapted the text they were copying. Other scholars, such as Barnes, argue for a more optimistic view and suggest that the manuscripts contain fairly faithful reflections of the original translations. It's important to note that the level of scribal intervention varies substantially between romances. For example, Ivan's Saga, the translation of Chrétien de Troyes' Ivan ou le Chevalier au Lion, is a close translation as it retains all of the plot elements, but about 40% of the original romance's length. So that's quite a bit shorter. In contrast, Eric's Saga, which is a translation of Chrétien's Eric et Enid, is more akin to a rewriting with substantial narrative restructuring and changes to the thematic interests that are explored in the saga. There's no clear answer to identifying the changes to the translated romances as without surviving manuscripts and the exemplars from which they were copied from. It is impossible to know whether a modification took place in Norway or in Iceland. But despite this, there are noticeable trends in translated texts which suggest certain thematic, stylistic and structural changes to adapt the romances to perhaps Norwegian or Icelandic pre-existing literary and cultural conventions. All of the Francophone romances were written in verse, but translated into prose. Prose is the dominant literary form in medieval Iceland and Norway. And so this formal change in the narrative illustrates the choice of translators in adapting to a native form, and thus one more familiar to audiences to convey the material. The loss of poetic form also impacted the aural and rhythmical quality of the narratives. However, a new literary style, sometimes called courtly style, was developed, which strove to capture the tonal and musical qualities of the original French. This style is characterized by alliteration, the frequent use of present participles, synonyms, and parallelisms. There's also a general tendency to abbreviate the romances with lengthy monologues, descriptions, narratorial commentary, and psychological analyses omitted. The result are texts which are much closer in style to the Icelandic sagas. There's also frequently reductions in emotional displays, although this is not an indication of a lack of emotionality or an interest in emotions on the part of Norse audiences, as Caroline Larrington and Sif Rickard sort of highlighted. Rather, it is an adjustment to conventional emotive scripts which medieval Icelandic audiences were familiar with. Whereas Chrétien and many of the romances give extended monologues and psychological analyses of characters' emotional turmoil, the Norse texts often frequently focus on the action, and so audiences are expected to interpret the emotions and motivations from behavioural performance. We've talked a little bit about the why and the how. Now let's turn to what do these translations say about society and culture in medieval Norway and medieval Iceland. But here I think it's a good moment to turn to a case study and examine precisely how a text could be translated. For this, I'm going to focus on the translation of Vie de France's Les Lefrains, which was translated as Eskia in the Old Norse collection Strenglecker, which is preserved in the manuscript Uppsala Delagardi 47 and dated to circa 1270. Marie was writing most likely around 1150, in or around the Angevin court of Henry II in England. Her poems are short, courtly narratives which typically explore the theme of courtly love. Her Les Lefrains tells the story of a woman who slanders her neighbour as she accuses her of adultery when she gives birth to twins. When the woman who first spoke ill of her neighbour becomes pregnant, she too gives birth to twins, but decides to send one away rather than admit to the public shame of an accusation of adultery or admitting that she had lied. The little girl is raised at an abbey, where she later meets her lover and leaves the abbey to leave with him. At the end of the lay, the girl and mother are reunited, and the girl legally marries her lover. The Norse translation of this lay offers some interesting insights into both translation strategies and ideological principles underpinning the translation of this short narrative. One example of a translation strategy is an explanation which occurs in a reference to a tournament in the Norse text. We are told that the girl's lover stops by the abbey while riding back from a tournament. Tournaments were a popular and common form of entertainment in medieval France and England, and so Marie did not need to explain this to her audience, who would have recognized it as a conventional aristocratic chivalric activity. However, neither tournaments nor jousting were familiar events in 13th century Norway, and so the Norwegian translator includes a small explanatory note to help audiences understand the text, and I'll read it out to you now in English from Matthias Tveitens and Robert Cook's edition and translation. This lord was called Gudrun by name. It happened then that he went to a tournament where knights ride singly at each other to test their knighthood. End quote. What this small insertion tells us is that not only are the activities of the knightly class unfamiliar to Norse audiences, but so are the purpose of these activities. Another critical change to the ideological structure underpinning Eskia is the emphasis on learning courtly customs. It was widely believed that nobility and courtliness were inherent characteristics amongst the medieval French aristocracy. Therefore, despite the fact that the girl Lefrain, as she's known in Marie's text, is not raised amongst the aristocracy, her naturally refined courtly conduct is evidence of her superior lineage, and this is what wins her lover and leads to the events of her eventual reintegration into society and reconciliation with her family. Such an ideology was both foreign and unsuitable to an audience in Norway, as it excludes Norse audiences from engaging courtly conduct if they're not already born into it. Rather, as Michael Anger has shown, the Norse translation focuses on Eski's ability to learn courtly conduct so that she offers a model for which audiences could emulate. For example, Marie de France's text states that Garun has fallen in love with Lofgren because, and here I'll read from Glenn S. Burgess and Keith Busby's translation, he saw that she was very beautiful and well-educated, wise, courtly, and well-brought up. End quote. In the Norse version, Garun loves Eski because he saw that she was extremely beautiful, well-mannered, and wise, and trained in courteous customs. End quote. The additional emphasis in the Norse text, trained in courteous customs, is a very small change, but one which, in fact, transforms the ideological structure of the text. Norse presents courtliness not as inherent, but learned. It offers an appealing model of exemplary conduct as something that is taught and can be learned, and which is rewarded with social status and public acclaim. Desirable objectives in a changing society as courtiers sought to gain the king's approval and support. By pointing to the capacity for courtliness to be a learned characteristic, the translated text also points to its own self-reflexivity, and possibly also the institutional priorities underpinning the translation. The prologue of this collection of Old French Lays stresses the educational function and the role of public instruction in educating audiences of Haakon's court. As Eski presents a young woman deprived of her family, but offered a new education, one set in an ecclesiastical context, the abbey. An abbey's replace is often associated with book learning. The translated text draws attention to its own role in communicating and educating its audiences so they too can receive social acclaim for refined conduct. Closely connected to this role of book learning is the role of the abbey in the Norse translation. So I mentioned earlier Bjørn Banlien's argument that Haakon sought to change the behavior of his courtiers in conjunction with the church. As my research focuses on the translation of space and place, the pronounced role of the abbey as a place of learning and courtly influence in the Norse translation of Eski is quite significant. One of the key changes in the Norse text is the abbess's speech when Eski is about to leave the abbey to go live with her lover. In Marie's text, the abbess's speech is reported, so we don't hear her speak directly, and thus her voice is obscured. And we are simply told that abbess told the girl that she'd raised her as her niece. The Old Norse translation gives a very interesting, expanded account in which the abbess speaks directly to Eski and stresses her pedagogical role. And I'm going to read this quote out to you because it's quite long, but it's very interesting. So, beginning quote, "I've raised you and respected you, honored you and instructed you in manners, taught you the good forms of polite and courteous womanhood, and fostered you and raised you as my own relative and foster daughter, always with affection and esteem." End quote. The speech is a tender outpouring of genuine love between abbess and abandoned girl. The abbess seems almost to lament the loss of her foster daughter as she stresses her role as a substitute parent. However, her listing of her educational functions and the training she provided Eski to enable her to navigate the courtly world beyond the abbey represents a blending of secular and spiritual training. As a spiritual leader and a woman immersed in the doctrines of the church, the abbess equips Eski with a morally superior education and one which blends ecclesiastical and secular knowledge, which will enable her to succeed and win renown. By positing the abbess as the main educator of courtly values, the Norse translation suggests, in fact, that correct courtly education lay in the hands of clerics and the church as the primary authority on secular courtly conduct. By interconnecting secular and spiritual knowledge in order to successfully perform courtliness, the Norse text posits ecclesiastical authority for the dissemination of courtly education, while implying that courtliness also carries spiritual benefits. This offers another appealing aspect of this new cultural system to encourage audiences in Haakon's court to adopt this new social and cultural ideology. And so, to conclude, I hope to have shown to you today the interconnectedness of medieval Norwegian and Icelandic literary production within wider medieval European cultural trends. Medieval romances were some of those widely produced and copied narratives at the time. And so Haakon's program of translation was an active engagement in transforming the cultural practices and using literature to reshape the cultural identity and social ideals of his court. Literature was a powerful vehicle for creating multicultural connections which stretch from the Mediterranean to Norway. It's very likely that Haakon, or I should say, it's very possible that Haakon exploited the images of kingship and courtly conduct in the translated romances to strengthen his monarchy and realign the conduct of his courtiers alongside their continental peers. These texts offer potent images of kingship and courts, and their translation illustrates the role of literature in communicating these ideals, but also transmitting ideas across geographic, political, cultural, and linguistic boundaries. This small example from the translation of Marie de France's text offers an insight into translators' responses as they interpreted and reshaped narratives. Foreign concepts needed to be explained, political ideologies communicated, new cultural values demonstrated, and institutional authority asserted. Translation was a powerful tool as it drew together a myriad of cultural strands as texts moved across borders, transforming with each new iteration, and so offering insights into these critical moments of encounter. The fantastic worlds of French court literature found a rich and welcoming home in medieval Norway and Iceland, where they flourished for centuries after their first contact.
This has been an episode of The Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 4 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Meara, Logan Quigley, and me, Lauren Lee, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with the latest episodes. Thanks for listening.